Welcome to another episode of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your semi-helpful host, Director of Online Content at SimSec, Matthew Hipple, and I will be joined today by a co-host from the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, Jerome Laidman. We'll be talking to Major General David Edgington, United States Air Force retired, and since we're here with the CRIC today, obviously we're going to be concentrating to a point on innovation, but we will be discussing his time in Kosovo, in Baghdad, and in acquisitions. So it's a very broad experience that General Edgington has, and one that's very rewarding to listen to, and we will be definitely bringing him back on the podcast to go into some of these stories in depth. But for now, sit back, relax, and we will be back to you with General Edgington after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control Podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And welcome back to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. So we've got a few beers, we've got some chips, some salsa here, and we're sitting down for a conversation. I got my co-host here with me for today. Jerry, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, Captain Jerry Lauderman, CNO's Rep Innovation Cell. Excited to be here today with our guest, Major General Dave Edgington, formerly retired out of the Air Force. And, sir?
Hi. Dave Edgington, again, as these boys pointed out here, retired two-star from 33 years of service in the Air Force. Give you a little bit of the background, but I retired last job in 2010. I was the Chief of Staff of Joint Forces Command under General Mattis before its dissolution. Most of the questions I get are what happened to JIFCOM and why, but not pertinent to our discussion today. I flew fighter aircraft most of my career, spent a lot of time in the Pentagon as well. And so when I tell people elevator speech of what I was involved in, again, flying fighters is probably the basic, and I'm not a pilot, I'm a navigator trained WISO, weapon systems officer is what they call, and broke a few glass ceilings getting to the point of command and flag, which isn't easy, I guess, in that realm, but I was given some very, very unique opportunities. Pentagon assignments, again, I won't go through all of those, but I've seen things from the Air Staff, from the Secretary of Staff, and from the Joint Staff, and had the good fortune of working for some of the most noted senior leaders in some of the most noted conflicts that we've had, because I've also been a special assistant to General Wes Clark, Supreme Allied Commander of Europe during the Kosovo campaign, and was the senior airman in Baghdad as a two-star, as the air component commander, or the, not the commander, but the air the coordination element in Baghdad. And so I sat with General Petraeus during the surge with General Odierno as the corps commander on a daily basis, coordinating all of the air support as necessary and all of the policies and tactics and so forth that went on with that during the surge in 2007-2008. And then acquisition, I went to that job in the from an acquisition role in the Pentagon. So when I articulate my qualifications to folks in industry, I basically say, you know, I've seen it from the operational end of employing weapons to determining the needs. One of the jobs at the Pentagon was the deputy of requirements to the acquisition piece, and then to industry after, of seeing the whole spectrum of how we get new equipment from the definition of what a gap is in a warfighting capability.
So that's perfect for today's topic, since we're here with SimSec and we're here with CRIC at the same time. We're going to talk about that innovation concept, and we're going to flow from the operational into that leadership and then acquisition, because you have all three in spades. And I guess we'll start out with, since we've got ISIS rising up in Iraq and Syria, you were there during the air campaign in 2007, 2008, when the surge started, and you had time in Kosovo. So you've seen different kinds of air campaigns, and you've seen one of the most recent important air campaigns that we've conducted that's now seeming to come up again. So I guess I'll just open the topic for you to wax poetic on that innovation or the changes that you saw from going from the sort of Pax Americana, our moment of hyperpower there in Kosovo, to all of a sudden finding yourself in Baghdad and sort of in the midst of a major surge against an insurgency.
Well, I'll, even for your audience, I'm going to define for these guys that I want them to interrupt and ask questions whenever there's something that's going through, because you have just opened a book on a lot of things that I could talk about. And when I think about innovation, most people think about technology and toys. I've got some examples of those, specific examples that happened in Baghdad, but a lot of things also, I'll tie it also to personnel, leadership, things that you had talked about. But there's even one other aspect of this, and I hate to sound like the advertisement for Joint, but the understanding that any of us would bring from our specialties, specific to me, bringing an air representation of senior air, employment of air, to somebody like a General Wes Clark, who would sit here today and tell you that he needed to rely on guys like myself for checking his assumptions of what he could do. An example in that, and I'll get to the Baghdad piece, but an example in the Kosovo War is General Clark, his reputation, and quite frankly, anybody who knows him, he didn't have the greatest reputation among people who worked for him, because he was a micromanager. He wanted to control everything. And at the Supreme Allied Commander level, he had component commanders, he had regional commanders. Admiral Ellis was supposed to be running the war. Admiral Ellis was almost, I don't want to say bad, but neutered for his ability to control the war, because Wes Clark ran everything. And we, as his special assistants, and I had counterparts, two from the Army, two from the Navy, or, one Navy, one Marine, another Air Force guy, we were kind of his daily staff to take him through. And so I got to sit through VTCs in the morning and sit all night long monitoring the war in his chateau on 24, essentially it was 26-hour shifts, but before we shift over to the other guy and take over a day, you could watch how he ran the war. General Clark had a habit of saying, just give me an F-15, I want to take out that tank. And it was up to guys like me to kind of put a perspective on it. Yes, you're the commander ultimate, and you can do that, but you don't need to be defining what targets are, and more specifically, you don't need to be telling me what airplane that I need to put. You tell me what you need accomplished, and I'll tell you what the best weapon and the best way of doing it is. And it doesn't mean, because I'm an Air Force guy, I'm going to try to put an Air Force jet in there. There may be a Navy jet or a Marine Corps jet that's out there that's a better asset. Or specifically, even to Kosovo, I watched the whole thing of trying to get Apaches into the war fight that Clark was trying to get over there to be able to have an effect on the forces that he wanted to have an impact on. So you get to see the whole logic and the thought process of why we've got a joint targeting cell, why we've got a joint application of forces, why we've got component commanders with recommendations. And I guess the point of that is that my experience and some of these senior leaders is that people default to their concept of, I'm in charge, I want to do this, I've got to do it my way, that has to constantly be checked by the people that are there. And in a way of innovation, that's what we're really trying to train our junior forces as they raise to senior leadership positions, is to be able to step in and say, no, you don't want to do that. And because of the fact that this is recorded, I'm going to give you some of the examples where I actually stood in front of General Clark at my own potential peril and said no. And he said, what? And I said, no, sir, you don't want to do that because of this, this, and this. But if I said, I'm a good military, soldier airman, I will salute smartly and do it, but I want you to know the impact of what you just asked me to pass on as your order before. And he was, that's why I think he would smile across the table with me today and say, he's right. He did give me some candid advice that I needed to hear a couple of times, because and in a way for innovation of the thought process, you have to establish that relationship and credibility with bosses and have the gumption to stand up to them at some time respectfully and back off to do what he tells you. But sometimes, especially senior leaders, you need somebody to tell you as the emperor that your pants are down.
If I can quickly, before we get to the Baghdad scenario, maybe flesh out, what do you think that you lose? So from that scenario, discussion is endless. It's been happening since the 1800s about micromanagement of subordinates. But from your observation, in a scenario like that, where you are the component commander and you're the air guy, or you're in charge of your unit, you are able to adapt and innovate based on the scenario. What is lost when someone above you starts micromanaging like that?
You can get better at it. You can feel handcuffed, but essentially that's his role, and his perception of what his authorities are is defined, but it's not in stone. And so it's his prerogative to be able to do that. And when every one of us rises to the next level of command, you're a product of your experience. And so some people have seen this before and were frustrated by not being able to do it. So by God, when they're in charge, they're going to do it their way. All of us are military soldiers, and we're going to obey those legal orders given to us by the officers appointed above us, and so we're going to do that. I think my approach goes back to really what I was echoing there, is that we're all trained, but we're all products of our experience and all products of the training that we received. I would not say that a General Wes Clark, certainly not General Petraeus, or any of the senior leaders that I've worked for in the past, were not even more trained than me and did not even retain greater of the education level that was there. Being put in the position of the responsibility, everybody has their own perception. Boy, if we could write a book on leadership that told you exactly the right way to do it and it was accepted by everybody, we would only need one book. But guess what?
There are a million books
out there, and everybody's got a different perspective. And, oh, by the way, every leadership environment you're in has so many different aspects to it that you have to be able to adapt and see. And the best leaders are the ones that, number one, get the mission accomplished, but number two, keep their people involved, engaged, and understanding, and in many cases satisfied with how they're moving ahead. And so that's the challenge to all of us, is to see the entire environment. What are the environmentals that impact this? What are the directions above? Am I doing what my boss or supreme commander is giving me as far as the mission, his mission tasking orders? And then what is within my prerogative to be able to do, and how do I do it with the talent that I've got assigned to me? And that's, that is a leadership in a nutshell. There is no nutshell that'll hold leadership. So, we've all got to be able to try to find our own way in that.
Jerry? So for innovation, I mean, it's an interesting topic, leadership and innovation. How do you, as a leader, for both your superiors, but also your subordinates, how do you balance that fine line between, being a commander and, having to make the hard decisions, but as well allowing your people the necessary space, creative space, as you will, to do what they need to do to get the job done?
That must have been the bonus question, because you just got the ding there. balance is probably the key word. In fact, when I give leadership talks, I usually key it around the word of balance, because there's no one solution, one way of doing anything that's right. Again, it all depends on personalities and the environment. That said, I have always been of the leadership school of trying to trust your subordinates. Now, there are subordinates who have their own personal agenda. There are subordinates who have somebody else's agenda. And there are, unfortunately, in human nature driven, subordinates who are more concerned about their own advancement than they are about the unit or supporting the commander's objectives. And you just have to be perceptive early on to be able to identify those. Those who fall in that latter category are by no means bad soldiers, sailors, airmen, or Marines. They just need a little more motivation, and that's not to be said in a negative way. It's the right coaching to ensure that they understand how to apply themselves to be the most effective, and ultimately that will take care of your own career. And that I think that I've benefited from that myself, but I know that one of the key questions, trick questions, whatever you want to call it, that I would have for people who are interviewing to be executive assistants or very close staff to me was, tell me why you want this job. 90% of the time it's, I'm coming up for promotion, or I need this, or I'm falling behind my peers in this, or I want to be able to get selected to go to school. And those are very legitimate answers, but those weren't the answers that got the guy hired, because I would tell the guys afterwards that I would hire the individual who came in and said, you know, I understand what you want to do, and I want to help you get there. Or this, you know, I'm passionate about my commitment to this unit, and I think that, you know, if there's any part that I can play to make this unit better, I want to be able to do that and facilitate your ability to lead this unit to mission success. You know, that's where we need the ding from your phone, because, you know, ding, 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 that's the magic question. That's the answer that you need, because that if you can coach your people to say, look, I'll credit General Hornberg with, who was a retired Air Force four-star, but he was one of my mentors early on, in one of his leadership discussions for brand new flag officers when I had just been selected for flag. He had a speech that I never forgot. He said it was all about the four U's. The first U is the U.S., the United States, your oath to your country and the loyalty and what we're trying to do. It's all about that. The second one is about the USAF, but essentially you could take that to the Marine Corps, the Navy, whichever, to your service. Your loyalty is to your service, and you're there to execute what your chief of staff has given you, and likely it's very logical. The third U was your unit. That, you know, once you're in line with what the country wants and what your service wants, then by God, you're devoted to your unit. And the fourth one is it doesn't start with a U, but it's you. You got to take care of yourself and your family, and you got to be making, but it's in that order. That's the important thing. When you start reversing that, and the top thing on there is thinking about yourself, then you're subordinating your loyalty and dedication to your unit, your service, and your country, and that's backwards. And that's where you need to kind of coach your people, as we all raise in leadership, to just keep those priorities in line. It doesn't mean you ignore any of them. You balance them. But that's where you kind of, you know, help coach those individuals and find those right things to be able to lead them along. And then you've got to establish, and this goes specifically, I think, to your question, your innovation, you've got to establish an environment where people do not fear stepping out and taking a bit of a risk. I've done that many times in my career, you know, the Clark thing being notwithstanding one of the examples that I gave you, but it's like, you know, as long as I'm not putting anybody's life in danger, violating any moral or legal standard, if you think it through, if it's just against regulations, well, regulations can be changed. It doesn't mean violating regulations, but it means, okay, if this is something I want to do and there's a regulation in my way, let me examine whether or not we can get a waiver or change a regulation for it. But you define those things to make sure you establish the criteria you're not going to go without. But creativity, you got to reward that with your people. You got to encourage them to think outside the box. You got to think, you know, here's a mission, here's an objective that we're trying to get to. What would 90% of the population would think this is the approach? That doesn't mean that it's not the right approach. Is there something more creative that would either be more efficient, more effective, or, you know, a smarter way of getting this accomplished? And if you can find that, then reward that. But don't have people feel like, you know, this is not what I would have done. I used to tell people as a leader, when I would first walk in, the first thing is that I'm... and this was one, I'll credit this to General Colin Powell. He's got a quote that I embraced in a book that I had read with him one time that said he's got a wide zone of indifference. And that's something that I've told people. And people don't understand that on definition until it gets explained. There are multiple ways of doing things. And I'm of that same ilk, that if a subordinate comes to me and say, this is the issue, most of the time they're going to wait for you to give them direction as a senior leader or as a leader of any sort. And usually I'll say, what's your suggestion? And they'll give me their suggestion. I want them to feel like they're emboldened and empowered to think this through and present a solution to me. And quite frankly, the only thing I do is not do I prefer that solution or not. When they're telling me the solution or the proposal for that solution, I say, if I think he can get there with this solution, then I'm going to approve it. Go for it. I got no problem with it. Let's do it your way. Because there are many ways to skin a cat, poor use of words, but there's many ways to do that, to accomplish things, and it doesn't have to be my way. I want the innovation. I want to foster the environment where people want to present a solution and know that their boss is going to back them up and allow them to execute it their way. And that's, I think, the way that you foster that environment.
So we don't have a bell, but I do have this.
So I guess like, does that work? I don't.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about that. You've laid out a very sort of rich tapestry of what you're talking about in innovation, what you're talking about leadership. So taking that and applying it, both operationally and you mentioned before we started the podcast with technology. You observed a lot of that on the acquisition application side when you got to Baghdad. So taking those ideas with General Petraeus showing up, with the plan that was put together by him and what some people call the Coindonistas, who stood out and said, this is how we're going to prosecute this war, this is how to win, and this is how they changed the tide of our strategy. So you got there, you showed up a month after they did. How did you see this innovation, this leadership? How did you apply it? How did you see it acted out around you in both the personnel and operation side, but also, like you mentioned earlier, that technology side of we've got all these different kinds of new weapons and we're trying to apply it to this irregular war?
Yeah. Well, first let me set the stage on the Baghdad assignment, the fact that, yes, I was the senior two-star in theater with General Petraeus, but I was... I had an identity crisis the whole time that I was there, not a personal one, but a definitional one, because General Petraeus saw me as his senior Air Force guy, two-star, should be able to turn to and get an answer for everything, but I really actually worked for General North, who happened to be the three-star CFAC, who was down in Kuwait and half of the time back in Shaw Air Force Base, South Carolina, as a dual hat. So it wasn't even like having a dual boss, because I've had dual bosses in many of my NATO roles. There was really no official line for me to General Petraeus, except on behalf of the Air Force that offered me as the senior ace representative in Baghdad. That said, even it came all the way through my entire year to the point where my end-of-tour decoration was signed two different pieces of paper, one by General Petraeus and one by General North, because they both.
Does that mean you got two?
Then I got one, but I didn't make it an issue as to which one needed to sign it, because I knew that it legally needed to be signed by Air Force, but the guys in Baghdad were like, you know, General Petraeus is the one who gives the okay, then I'm happy for General Petraeus to give this to me. So anyway, that sets the stage for it.
That's an innovation, too. Administrative innovation.
Well, it is. It's looking for, you know, again, this is one of those analysis of, is there anything wrong with this, you know? And not really, you know, except for wasting one of the four stars' times, three stars or four stars. But if they both felt passionate about the fact that they had this authority, then let them both feel like they accomplished something. I'm happy with that. Anyway, you talked about the innovation there. I found myself in that role because, I had another one of these bosses on the Air Force side who he was passionate about his command authority, and so I was not given a whole lot of leeway to be able to make decisions. I was more of a liaison and an understanding and an articulator of the Air Force doctrine and how air could best support the battle plan. The battle plan that had come up was done by intelligent people, extraordinarily well versed in the combat operation over there, and I saw, as I analyzed, attended meetings, and was asked questions on it, there was nothing that I needed to do to drastically change how we were implementing that as far as the overall strategy and daily operational tasks that were there. And it was my role to ensure that the ATO, the air tasking order, was reflective of what the priorities were set by the commander and the division commanders who I went around Iraq and met with all of those. So that was kind of my role, was to liaise and to ensure that that the airman's perspective was heard, but the needs of the joint combatant coalition commanders were being translated correctly and being met to the best ability possible by the air component that was there. That said, I do allude to the fact that there are some things that I was able to have an impact on. At one point, we had, especially when we were going into Sadr City in downtown Baghdad, there was a lot of Shia militia that were. I don't want to say hostile to U.S. troops. Obviously, the guys who have fought in that area will take issue with that because they were hostile to U.S. troops. But they were trying to establish a Shia-dominant environment within Baghdad to protect a Shia-dominant government. And so this was an area of the city where they were able to fester and grow and prosper, and we needed to take that down to ensure the opportunity for both Shia and Sunni to get together and foster the government that we were trying to help them implement, of one of representation. And so we would go in and fight the Shia in Sadr City and try to get in there. As a result, there were times where we went in and the air component was called in for a task order or a targeting event, where we would drop a bomb on a building and drop a building, and then we would have 20% additional civilian casualties or some unintended consequences of a building next door. And this is not brand new, but there has always been how do we reduce the collateral damage? How do we got precision because of laser and GPS ordnance and so forth, but the explosive nature is just a little more than what we need, but we can't get a Hellfire missile in close enough, or we can't get something that's a little smaller. Is there any way of getting a precision-guided, reduced collateral damage weapon in? Well, I had worked on something that was new development that the Air Force was going to be. It was a carbon fiber casing for a weapon that didn't have the metal that flew out, but the carbon fiber, when it exploded, kind of dissipated. But that wasn't ready yet. That was still 4 or 5 years down the line before something like that was going to be ready, and they weren't even we weren't even guaranteed that the funding was going to continue coming on that. This was in my acquisition role in the Pentagon prior to getting there. But we had also I knew from the Pentagon and discussions there and talking to some of the weapons manufacturers that that when it comes down to a weight and balance on a bomb, that essentially whatever you put in the bomb, as long as the weight and balance is right, it's going to take some testing and some engineering to ensure that the bomb is balanced correctly, but it'll fly the same pattern no matter what's inside it. And so the concept of a partially filled concrete munition was, I had heard this before, I don't want to be the one who claims the genesis of this, but when the discussion came up in Baghdad, I was pushing that to say, have we thought about how we can get whether we can ask for just a regular 500-pound bomb, but put concrete in whatever portion you need? You tell me, from the warfighter perspective, what lesser percentage of explosive you want out of a precision munition to hit the target you think that we caused a problem with on whatever has propelled this discussion. And so we found out what reduced percentage they wanted. I called back to the Pentagon, and I said, is this still viable? They said, yeah, anything we pay for it is there. And I knew from my acquisition experience the ways of getting things through, and I know this is what you guys are talking about as well, as far as how do you get something quickly that has a game-changing capability. Now, this isn't going to bring the war to its knees, but it's certainly going to reduce the collateral damage, political, diplomatic problems that we have. There's something called a JUONS, which I'm sure everybody understands, Joint...
I don't know what a JUON is.
You don't know what a JUON is. Operational need. Joint urgent operational need. I knew it would come to me. Those things fade when you're retired a couple of years. But yeah, it's JUON, joint urgent operational need, that can come from a combatant commander, a joint combatant commander, and that goes right to the top, and there are ways to put together a justification to this that goes into either service-specific or to an OSD joint environment within the Pentagon to go through a few verifications of, yes, this is a legitimate need. Yes, we do have something that can meet this. No, we don't have to go through, because of the potential expense of this program, we don't have to develop a whole program office. We can do an offshoot of, in this case, an existing munition. Yes, we're going to have to pay a little R&D to create the mix, do the testing for weight and balance, and be able to make sure the release characteristics are the same. But it's not that hard to create the engineering behind what goes through this. So I will claim that I wrote the JUON, but I cast a little bit of this out. I wrote several paragraphs of it, but the majority was a couple of deputies that I had in Baghdad. But we crafted this. I reviewed it from what I had seen before and what I understood of the system of what we would need in the Pentagon to get this through. And ultimately, within about 3 months, we had these weapons in theater. So it can be done very quickly when you understand the right mechanisms to go through, how to write the justification, ensuring you got the right authorities asking for it, and where to make a few phone calls to say, this is coming, I need fast action, it has lives, it has a lethal aspect to it of an existing combat scenario, and you can get it through pretty quick.
Jerry?
So, sir, speaking a little bit more on the innovation in acquisitions, from your time in the Pentagon, as the director for Air Power?
Global Power Programs, which was all of the fighters, bombers, and weapons.
Some of the examples of acquisitions, you know, of sort of the innovative, disruptive technologies, you know, how would you recognize those, and what aspects of those would you encourage to proceed forward with them?
Again, everybody gets a vote, and probably the biggest restrictive factor is the budget. Everybody gets a vote, everybody gets an idea, and there's a plethora of ideas that are there, and most of those are, I will blame this, I will say that this exists in the Pentagon, but this exists in every environment, everywhere. People get a passion. They get their cause celeb, they get their ticket they think is, you know, if I get this done, then I'm going to be the hero, and I'm going to get early promotion and you know, a command or whatever it might be. It's an unfortunate human nature aspect to be able to try to keep those in check, to not rein on the excitement and the passion, but still put that in perspective of, you know, I got 10 of these that are all good ideas, and we can't even afford one of them right now. So we got to pick the one that's the most, it's the most verified, validated need of what's going to have the impact quick. And that doesn't mean that these other 8 ideas or 7 ideas aren't, you know, sterling ideas, which, oh, by the way, allow me to get off of that highway for just a second. This is exactly what happens in industry. The first briefing with the last company I worked with, I was with for 2 years, and they brought me in among 3, and there was an Army rep, a Navy rep, and myself, all former flags. We go around this, I listened to this first introductory briefing that I was in. It just happened to be the first day that I was there, but it was, you know, these type of things. And this guy said, we got this capability. It's so good that the Department of Defense needs it. Just think of how many hundreds of thousands we can make by selling this to them, and look at what they will do, you know, what it will provide them. And everybody around the table was all jumping on board, excited about this. Wow, this is great. And it came to me, and I was like the last guy, first day. And I sat there and I said, God, I hate to do this, but I said, have you talked to anybody in the military yet and find out if they have this need? Now, that when they see it, they're going to want it. And I said, wrong. That is the absolute backwards way to go about doing this, because the military has more needs for combat than they can ever fill. And so the best way to go about this is to go talk to them and find out, in this realm, do they need something like this? Then let them discuss what parameters are of how you be able to build this capability, so that they're part of defining and getting the solution that they ask for. But if you bring them something off the shelf that, and then try to convince them they need it, well, they're going to put that up against the 2,500 things that they need that they've already written out that they need and they can't afford, and they're going to say, thanks, but no thanks. And everybody around the table was like, well, you just kind of, you know, put the snafu on that. I said, I'm being realistic. I'm telling you, from a guy who sat in a position of making these decisions before, how not to do it. So get back over to how the military does innovation and the things that go through the Pentagon. You want to foster those ideas, but you've got to make sure that you've defined from all the stakeholders what is the most important thing, what are the things that you need it to do, and are we talking to the people who want to operate this thing? I can't tell you how many systems we've developed through engineers, acquisition people writing a document that says this is what we need, and engineers designing it, and it gets out to the operational guy, and he said, well, that's all fine and dandy, but I'm fighting in the desert, and this thing, you know, melts at 102 degrees. This is stupid. And we've just thrown all that money away because we haven't talked to the people who are going to use it. And the people who do the acquisitions are smart as how of all the regulations that they have to be able to do and make sure that they're responsible for money and they have certificate. But they don't have the operational experience of what's going to happen. And the engineer, he's smart. He's going to build whatever you tell him to build. And we'll maybe ask a few questions about, do you want it to turn left or right when it gets to that juncture? But he's going to design what you tell him. So if you don't have all three talking, you're never going to get the development of what's necessary.
What's the best way to bridge that gap? They call it the Valley of Death, I've heard, between the warfighter and the engineer.
It's the simplest word, and it's the hardest thing to do. It's communication. I hate to tell you that, but I can't tell you how many times I've sat in Pentagon acquisition briefings, and they put guys like me from operational experience, wing command, fighter aircraft, they put guys like me in positions like that in the Pentagon to be able to have the courage to stand up and say, No, stop. You're wasting money. You're not talking to the right people. Too often, we're either subsumed with the amount of things that we're doing, or we don't have the courage to stand up, or it's not our cause celeb for the day. But there's too many times that the guys in those positions don't speak up. But we've got to be able to train our folks to just say, look, it's a simple matter of communications, but it's the most difficult thing in the world. And everybody's consumed with operational timing and being able to fill their schedule for the day. But I'll tell you what, if we're going to make a crucial decision about how to move ahead with a new acquisition or a new capability that we're developing, if the acquisition guy is sitting there and doesn't see the operator in the room, he ought to say, time out. I'm not even attending if I don't have an operator there to reflect. He's given me a piece of paper. He's written me an email. That's not good enough. I got to have a guy who thinks and lives this while we're in the room so we can have a discussion. If the operational guy is sitting there talking with the acquisition guy and they're working regulations, the operational guy's got to say, where's the engineer? I don't know what he doesn't know how to design until he's sitting there and he said, I can build everything you said, but you want it white or black? And the operational guy's going to say, well, I never really thought about that, but let me see. I'm going to use this probably 70% of the time at night, so maybe it ought to be black. There's things like that that you just don't think about until you get everybody talking together. And that's the hardest thing, is to keep a continual communication going so that you can work through these issues and so that the engineer who would never think to try to call an operator can call an operator and say, dude, this little widget is not going to go 90 degrees here, so I was thinking about turning it this way as I developed that. And the guy says, yeah, but I got my tanker is sitting and that's going to poke into his leg, and that's stupid. You can't do it that way. Bam. Engineer would have done it. Well, I can't fit it that way, so I'm going to do it that way, unless he talks to the operator. And so that's where the communication of the smallest little thing can make a huge difference as we develop our highly technical systems.
To show that, to kind of close out, to show that process of that way of thinking, of considering the operator, what the engineer is capable of, what industry can produce, what's one of the best technologies, either while you're in uniform or in industry, where you said, man, that was a win. I love this technology. It was awesome. And what is an example of something that just broke your heart to let go of? Because it was cool, it gave you a capability, but because there were other needs, that was something that had to be shelved.
I told you not to give me any prep questions. That probably was one that I would have needed to think through a little bit more. I think through some of the frustrations that I've had, and I've been able to get most of the stuff that we've wanted, and it's far beyond me being the one person that can have that. I can think through, the F-22, I think, is one of the most marvelous machines in the world. Yes, it costs an ungodly amount of money. And yes, we've had problems with the oxygen system, and we've had problems with other things. But, the Air Force originally wanted 700 of those. We end up having 180 of them right now, and it's not enough of them, and it took forever to get it done because of the cost and because of the oversight. We have so many people, both within OSD and within Congress, that slip it every couple years. That slips the money, takes money away from it, and you end up having an albatross of something that's being developed. I think the F-22 could have been a lot better of a system if we'd have kept early on to the commitment to developing it. Again, that's from an Air Force perspective. I know the Navy would have the same perspective on many of the systems that you guys have tried to develop and have suffered the same oversight dilemmas of trying to get the investment into it. This reduced collateral damage carbon fiber munition, which I haven't read anything recently. That may have been chopped from the chopping block. I don't know. I think that this is a hugely valuable asset to be able to go in and not count on shrapnel, to be able to take out some of the targets. The precision and modern day, the technologies that we have, it opens a whole new realm of taking out the guy who's sitting on his laptop computer in the third floor apartment that can be hit from this one direction, and not, you might wake up some people on the floor below, but that's about all, because it's not going to destroy anything but go in and take out that guy's computer and hopefully him, if you can send it in through that window, which you probably can. We've got, all kinds of different technologies that we've been trying to develop. I think that I hated to see, because this was one of the programs that I was oversight of at the Pentagon, the airborne laser going away. Conceptually, one of the most creative and potentially game-changing defense against missiles that anybody could ever have. A laser sitting on a 747 body that can go up and shoot, you know, thousands of miles and burn a hole through an airborne missile by tracking it. And the parallax and the power for a laser to be able to retain the power necessary, all huge engineering challenges. But all those engineering challenges mean a lot of money and a lot of failures and tests, and all of those things mean something else is not getting done. I wish we could have continued to be able to produce something like that. But in retrospect for the budget, that's where, when I was the Global Power Programs chief, I killed three programs that the Air Force had invested millions and millions of dollars in, because it was one of those, you can't keep them all, and they're going to take it against, you know, they're going to take money against this program because we can't keep the budget for all of those. So what's the low-hanging fruit? What's not meeting what it needs? What is a capability that was a gap that maybe not filled but can almost be taken care of by another system that's online or being produced? And take careful aim and shoot it. So, with some of those things that didn't get developed, they're a shame. But when you've sat in positions like I have, it's like, well, and I guess I would go back to you're talking about systems. I'll just put in the advertisement on GIFCOM. GIFCOM got dissolved as a command. We were doing I had all the loyalty in the world to that. And locally here within the Hampton Roads community, there were thousands of jobs that were set at stake. But when you look at what Secretary Gates was trying to do of getting the military smaller, I did not agree with a lot of the things that he said. I think it was a lot of old data of his justification of why getting rid of GIFCOM. But if you're going to get rid of a major command or a combatant command or a functional command, you really can't take issue with which one to get rid of that, you know, things could have been absorbed by getting rid of Joint Forces Command. It just means somebody else has got to do the work. And nothing that GIFCOM did was self-generated. It was all issued to us by the Joint Staff or other combatant commands that didn't want to do it. So, bam, we got them. So you've got to realize that sometimes you just don't have the capacity and somebody's going to have to take a shrink, and it means programs, it means organizational structures. There's no one perfect way.
So anything that you would recommend? Jerry, you have any final questions, thoughts? He's shaking his head, bad radio. So if he was good at radio, he'd say no.
he's just so fascinated by my discussions.
Exactly. He's speechless. books that you've read, people that you've engaged with, things that you've watched, just things in your life that you've encountered that other people can go out and seek. Other people can't go and fight the war in Kosovo.
Right.
So they have to go to these other sources. Something that, one or two things that you would recommend to our listeners that they should go out, they should read, they should watch.
You know, I've had a lot of people do that, recommend to me as well, and I'm not the type of person who completely hangs my hat on one specific thing. Most recently I read Secretary Gates' book Duty, and I won't say that that's something that all of your listeners should go out and read. But be aware of the things that are out there. I'm looking forward to reading Secretary Panetta's book because I want to read that and get a perspective on this administration and things that happened when I was in a senior leadership position. I'll tell you point blank that Secretary Gates' book, it took me months to read that because I reread probably the first six chapters or read them so slowly that I was processing every paragraph, because everything he was talking about, I was either in the room, worked for a guy who was in the room, or watched and was bleeding from GIFCOM decision being one of those, and trying to understand his perspective from his level and how that played out. I found the book very fascinating. It gave me a lot of insight on things that I didn't necessarily understand, even at the level of the things that I was seeing, of what was playing behind the scenes in politics and in the White House and what he was dealing with and negotiations with allied partners and other international entities. So I would just say, yeah, stay up with current events as best as you can. My recommendation would be don't ever accept one point of view as being the only point of view. And so if you hear something, read something, watch something, look for the other perspective. Form your own mind and have the courage of your own convictions to be able to determine what you think is right, and realize that everybody is probably in some way, shape, or form a product of their experience and may be tainted, myself included. And I have to check that all the time from all my joint schools and joint experiences. I still speak from the perspective of an airman. And so I check that when I'm talking to people to say, you know, I understand. I'm probably giving you something that's colored by an airman's perspective. This is how I see it, and it is, there's a legitimate alternate view. Doesn't mean it's wrong. Doesn't mean that mine's absolutely right. But it's worth understanding the perspective so that you can. And this is what I tell the Joint Forces Staff College schools and seminars that I go mentor, is just at least consider. And that makes you a better joint officer and a better leader for our future military forces.
Well, sir, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you.
Well, hopefully it's establishing something of value for you guys and for your
Absolutely.
Listening audience.
So. Absolutely. Right. You've been listening to the Sea Control Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Stream Radio, or Zune, or Xbox Music, if they even do podcasts anymore. I don't even know if that still works. Yeah, I still have my Zune. It's like, what, 13 years old? Nobody supports it with any software anymore. You can tweet us at SimSec. That is at CIMSEC. It's been a pleasure, and hope to have you all here next week. Thank you.